Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 4, Episode 12 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode we looked at Lewis Ferguson's Italian job, we looked at Gabri Vega's panache, we dissected the Bundesliga's serendipitous title race and we analysed the most recent edition of the Madrid Derby. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way, so do consult the show notes for a comprehensive overview of what we covered and when during the episode. This episode is of course produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Enjoy. Well, dear listener, we have a quite scintillating episode lined up for you this time around. Michael Jones is raring to go in the middle of a house move, might I add, but he's still, of course, raring to go to talk all things Italian football. Michael Jones, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Building off that last episode we did on Cremonese, who just picked up their first win over Roma, by who are chasing for the top four. So, yeah, really fascinating stuff over there and some new topics for this week as well. What about yourself, Ali?
Yeah, I'm good, Michael. Thanks for asking. Busy, but as I always say, busy is the best way to be. And yeah, just a shout out actually for that previous episode when you mentioned Cremonese. If you haven't listened to that previous episode, do go and check it out. Season 4, Episode 12, where Michael spoke at length about Cremonese's quite baffling season in more ways than one. This time around, we're going to cover the four leagues as we usually do. We're going to look at developing storylines in Spain, Italy, France and Germany. But we're going to start this time around with Italian football. Michael's probably thinking, why on earth does Serie A always end up pushed towards the back end of the agenda? I assure you, Michael, that's not something that I do deliberately. It just so happens. But anyway, this time around, I think Italian football deserves its place, as it would probably do more often than not, at the top of the agenda for this episode. What a month it has been for AC Milan. Now, if we cast our minds back to the 4 weeks between the beginning of January and the beginning of February, the Rossoneri played 8 games, lost 5 and conceded 19 goals in the process. Leaky. Since then, following their switch to a back three, Stefano Pioli's side have won 4 on the bounce without conceding a single goal. Is the formational change the only explanation for Stefano steering the ship into steadier waters at the San Siro? Some beautiful alliteration there, Michael. Take it away.
Yeah, well, the formational change has certainly been at the heart of it. And you said about them being leaky. Well, it's safe to say for now that leak has been sealed. 4 clean sheets in a row since really going to the back three. They had actually gone to the back three for the game before versus Inter Milan, but there's 2 key changes to that Derby de Miazza defeat, which we will go on to. But yeah, 4 really impressive wins over Torino, Tottenham Hotspur in the Champions League, first leg, second one to come up, Monza and Atalanta. So teams, you know, all of whom were expected and have provided really stiff opposition for big teams, both in Italy and, of course, Tottenham Hotspur beating Man City only a few weeks ago. So really tremendous run of form for AC Milan. And, you know, I think casting your mind back to that January, February period, the feel-good factor had certainly evaporated around the San Siro. You know, they, despite winning the league only at the end of last season, they had started the season okay, but I think because of Napoli's just extraordinary form, there's not really been a title race all season. And I think the fact that AC Milan's title defence almost finished before it began or shortly after it began, I think has really affected the morale over AC Milan. And, you know, Stefano Pioli, who I'll come on to a bit as well, he's done so much to build season on season in terms of league performance. And it's safe to say this season they've certainly regressed in terms of where they are competing for in the table, in the sense that they're in a top four battle rather than a title race. But it's been quite an unusual season. And it's been a difficult season for AC Milan. One of the things I was concerned about at the start of the season was the departure of Frank Kessié to Barcelona. I think that's had huge ramifications for AC Milan's midfield, which was one of their strong points last season. I think by the end of last season, they had the most effective and best balanced midfield in Italy. And if anything, amongst the top teams, they kind of, the impact of that departure meant they dropped towards one of the least effective sides in that respect. And I think that in itself is one of the reasons why this formation change has happened. But confidence has just dropped throughout the team, in the sense that they weren't scoring many goals. They were suffering huge defeats. They lost 4-0 to Lazio. They lost 5-2 to Sassuolo. Sassuolo, a team who had been out of form at the time as well. But since they went to... So they started with a 3-5-2 in this derby defeat to Inter Milan. And they lost 1-0 and they just didn't have the right balance going forwards. And since they've switched to a 3-4-3, which has worked really well for Stefano Pioli. And like we said, since then, it's four clean sheets. There's been a expected goals against improvement in those games from 1.2 down to 0.8. And the introduction of a certain young German defender called Malik Thiaw has been crucial for that. And the signing, I'm sure you will have seen a bit of him, Ali, from his time in the Bundesliga, albeit brief this season, but did a couple of seasons ago when they went down, but also spent time in the second division in Germany, where he was key to Schalke getting promoted last season. And he arrived for 7 million from Schalke after a few games this season, which I remember seeing a bit about at the time. And it was deemed quite a big departure, more for Schalke's loss rather than AC Milan's gain, with fans not really sure if he would actually even make that much of an impact. You know, despite it being ultimately such a huge opportunity for any 21-year-old defender. But he has really been sensational in these past four games. He's been very combative. He's been very calm. Someone who's been sort of thrown into the deep end. He'd made a few appearances earlier in the season, but I think it was just he'd helped them come on in late last year. He'd come on to help them see out victories against Hellas Verona, especially in the last few minutes. And then he had a 55-minute appearance in a victory over Fiorentina, but then kind of got overlooked for a couple of months. And fans were crying out for him, really, before he did get reintroduced into the team at the start of February. And he's been fantastic since then. And he did have experience playing in a back three. And I think playing a back three for AC Milan certainly helped him. He was playing in a back three for Schalke last season when they got promoted, often playing on the right-hand side. But he's playing alongside two defenders who are key to the title, charging for Keo Tomori and Pierre Kalulu. And I think what's really helpful for him is not that he's just playing alongside two young defenders who have proved themselves, showing that you don't necessarily need loads of leadership at the back to be effective, but that they've both had kind of similar trajectories, really. I think when Pierre Kalulu arrived from Lyon, it certainly wasn't easy for him. He didn't make an appearance, I don't think, in his first season before really breaking through. And Victor Kautamura is very much, much more an established player in the broke through, but he still had a massive point to prove after not really seeing much football for Chelsea in the season under Frank Lampard before. I think it was Thomas Tuchel in the end who oversaw his departure. But yeah, he's had an excellent sort of football in education through Bayer Leverkusen and Mönchengladbach, and a German under-21 international eligible for Finland, but I suspect he'll be playing for Germany, Die Mannschaft, before we know it. And I think that's been one of the really successful factors of this system. I think another really successful factor of them is that we talked about the struggles in number 10, for the number 10 in midfield, well, the number 10 role in particular has been a big one. And Frank Kessié had often played a more advanced role, despite not doing it as much for Barcelona this season. And I think with his departure, I think Ismail Benacer had struggled to be anywhere near as effective on the ball. And Charles de Ketelaere, who had arrived from Club Bruges, hadn't really made the impact I think many hoped they'd hoped for. But by moving into this role, I think they've allowed the likes of Brahim Diaz to focus more on playing as a wide forward, playing off the back of Olivier Giroud with Rafael Leao, also playing a bit more inverted and not being stuck out on the wing when the supply to him from those midfield positions hasn't been as good. We're also seeing the reintroductions or sort of improvements of other players, the likes of Radek Krunic and Junior Mathias. Mathias got a fascinating story coming from being a pizza delivery boy and working up at the divisions in Italy, and Radek Krunic, another place kind of really flown under the radar in Milan, have both taken really prominent roles in recent games. And, you know, ultimately, a lot of it does come back down to Stefano Pioli's man management. It's very much a team that he's built himself. The recruitment has been absolutely fantastic. And I think Malek Thiaw is another really excellent example with players. A lot of people from outside of Italy or outside of the clubs they've or slash leagues they've purchased from won't have known lots about these players. And I think even in De Ketelaere's case, I think he is a player who we do expect to gradually start to make more of an impact for the Rossoneri as time goes on. But it's an exciting time. Mike Maignan, the charismatic goalkeeper, has been so important. He was out since September. He's only just returned over the weekend when they defeated AC Atalanta 2-0. So did Zlatan Ibrahimovic off the bench. And although he doesn't quite have the same on-field impact, he certainly brings so much to the changing room and does help them see games through. And they've got their second leg next week versus Tottenham. They've got Fiorentina at the weekend first, which they'll be, you know, they're in a top four race. They'll be looking to build upon. But I think Fiorentina probably have less of an eye on the Serie A than AC Milan do with their exploits in the Conference League. So, yeah, exciting times for AC Milan. I just really hope that they're able to build on this excellent run of form by getting to the Champions League quarterfinals.
Bologna also kept a clean sheet at the weekend, producing the shock of the game week by defeating AC Milan's rivals Internazionale 1-0. Key to that victory was their Scottish attacking midfielder, Lewis Ferguson, who has been a revelation since arriving in Emilia Romagna. However, Ferguson has competition to be regarded as the most impactful Scot in Serie A this season, with Josh Doig excelling in a resurgent Hellas Verona team. On the outset, these moves may appear daring, leaving for Serie A, and yet, going off their success so far, do you think these moves appear more calculated, Michael?
Yeah, I think they're both examples of really good recruitment. I think you talk about sort of which Scot has had the most impactful success. I think it was easy in terms of Aaron Hickey for Bologna last season, and they certainly seem to have sort of been inspired by that recruitment in going to Aberdeen and signing Lewis Ferguson, who I just about missed when I went to watch Bologna earlier in the season. Bologna had quite a turbulent time at the beginning of the season, and so did Hellas Verona, really. But under new management for both teams, both players have really flourished. Now, Thiago Motta, I saw him in his first game at Bologna, and he didn't quite hit it off with the club's ultras. But since then, it's been a revelation, and they played some really fluid attacking football. Lewis Ferguson was installed into the team in his sort of preferred number 10 role quite early on as well. He started a narrow defeat against Napoli. I think they lost 3-2, which for any team in Serie A is good going this season, before having a scoring versus Lecce and a win, and then scoring goals both against Monza and Sassuolo. And the next month, the goal against Sassuolo is a screamer from outside the box, which won Serie A goal of the month for November. And he initially struggled to make an impact under Siniša Mihajlović. Obviously, it's clear now from his passing, it was a really tricky time both for him and his club, and, you know, what a legend of Italian football. But Thiago Motta, since he's come in, has really built. He's a manager who seems to get better with every job that he gets, and he seems to be bringing out so much in the attacking players around him, despite him being, you know, maybe renowned as a more defensive midfielder during his time. But he's really linked up well with the likes of Riccardo Orsolini. He seems to be playing the football of his life at the moment. And Ferguson's just a really sort of tenacious midfielder, which works well for this Bologna team, which do press quite aggressively. He could have had an assist in their victory versus Inter Milan at the weekend for a goal which was disallowed. Also could have had a penalty for potential handball. I think in both instances, Ferguson was offside. But he is really just showing, although the goals have dried up for him a little bit recently, he's been really impactful. And then you talk about Josh Doig as well. Maybe not a game for him to remember. He was hooked after 45 minutes in a defeat versus Fiorentina 3-0 last night. But he said, so yeah, Ferguson takes the Serie A impactful player Scott at the weekend. But Doig has, you know, he settled in much quicker. He scored on his full debut versus Sampdoria. But he'd also been part of a struggling team. They were bottom under Cremonese. He hadn't won a game at Christmas. And since the arrival of Marco Zaffaroni at the start of the year, really, you know, strange managerial appointment, had no real success in Italy's lower leagues. But he's coming in and he's actually had a really good instant impact so far. And Josh Doig, kind of playing as a wing back, but a very attacking one at that, has been really influential. He got assists both in their victories over Cremonese and Lecce, which has seen them go to right on the brink of the sort of the survival 17th position in Serie A. And they've got Spezia and Monza in the next few games as well, which is going to be huge to see if he can continue to make an impact. He's got two goals and three assists even this season. And I'm just going to quickly come to you, Ali, just wondering, you know, these are two players, you saw the impacts of Aaron Hickey last season. Do you think Serie A's, I mean, it seems to be a really good breeding ground for Scots at the moment, you know, especially young ones coming through who are having a great impact in Scottish football. But are you surprised at all by the impact they're making?
I would say pleasantly surprised that Ferguson and Doig have had the opportunities that they've had this season. I think there were two players who, when they were in Scotland, they stood out to an extent for sure. Obviously, they wouldn't have been recruited by Bologna and Hellas Verona if they hadn't done something to stand out. But yeah, I think I would say I'm pleasantly surprised. I think there's still room for development. I think Doig in particular is still quite raw. Ferguson as well has raw aspects to his game. But on the whole, yeah, pleasantly surprised. And if they can follow the same path as Aaron Hickey, i.e. moving to the English top flight as their sort of next step, then yeah, fantastic. It's all the better for the Scottish national team as well. And I was reading, I think it was earlier today, perhaps it was yesterday, that Motherwell's youngster Max Johnson has also been linked with a move to Motherwell. And I'm not sure how much of that is just paper talk, agent talk or whatever, and how much truth there would be to those reports. But hey, you know, it's one of those ones. There's obviously a pathway now, if you like, that's developing for Scottish players, young Scottish players, to go across to Italy. I'm thinking of Liam Henderson as well, who went across to Italy and was a huge success. So there is a pathway of sorts developing, and it can only be a positive, in my eyes anyway, for the Scottish game. Okay, on that really quite optimistic note for fans of Scottish football, for fans of the Scottish national team, I think we will draw our analysis of Italian football to a close. We are going to turn our attention now to German football, where we have a really quite tantalising title race on our hands. We'll be right back. In Germany, we would appear to have a mouth-watering Bundesliga title race on our hands. Just 5 points separate Bayern in pole position and Freiburg down in fifth place, with Union Berlin and Borussia Dortmund in particular giving the Bavarian league leaders a real run for their proverbial money. Now, to unpack and dissect all of this, I'm delighted to be joined by the excellent Nenad Baburdiker. Nenad is a freelance sports journalist based in sunny Manchester. He is one half of Everybody's Eats, an excellent league and podcast, and writes for multiple outlets, including the iPaper and Sporting Life. He's also a social media editor for the Bundesliga's English channels, working for a friend of the podcast, Byron Hutchison, who, of course, was involved with Pure Football previously and works for the Bundesliga. Anyway, Nenad, it's great to have you on. How are you?
Great to be here, Ali. Great to be here. No, I've been a big fan of the Road to Nowhere football podcast for a while now, so it's a bit of a mom, I've made it moment to be on the pod.
you flatter me. Flattery is always something that works with me, Nenad. So yeah, it's great to have you on. And as I was saying, we've got a fantastic title race in Germany. And what with you writing a lot about Germany, or German football rather, these days, and working with the Bundesliga, I thought, who better to get on to chat through all of that, to unpack all of that than yourself. And looking firstly at Union Berlin, I think the question that begs to be asked almost is, what factors are fueling their quite astonishing title push? And on a wider note, what would winning the Bundesliga or even simply securing Champions League football mean for the club as a whole, Nenad?
Yeah, so, I mean, you put it quite accurately there, Ali. I think astonishing is the perfect word for it. Union are experiencing a bit of a crazy run. I think fans, longtime fans of the club, will just be enjoying the ride at the moment. And in terms of the factors, I think what's really helped the club this season, at least on the pitch in terms of performances, is you see that they have been able to pick up points where they've dropped points last season. So I was looking at some of the results from last season up to game week 23, which is what we are up to at the moment. Union drew 7 games last season up until this point, but this season they've only drawn 4, which is quite impressive. I think they've made that leap, I think, in terms of the mental side of things, to be able to be resilient enough and sticking it out in games where they've otherwise dropped points before. So that's one reason. And I think another reason is the very fact that Urs Fischer brings a clear identity with this team, and that has never changed. The principles have never changed. So in that sense, I think there's been a lot of stability at the club, and that is always, I think, a positive element for new players coming in. We see there's often turnover, especially at Union. You see every summer star players leave, other players are brought in to replace those players in the aggregate. And this season, we have seen players coming in. You know, Diogo Leche is one of those players who has successfully established himself. And, you know, Juranovic more recently. I think these players, and Ruzulon even, of course, from Wolfsburg. But these players especially have benefited from Union's identity, I believe. And the very fact that the club are so coherent in their approach on and off the pitch. And again, that has just made it all the more easier. And then you see someone like Danilo Duki, I think, whose form a lot of people have focused on this year. You know, he's standing out a bit more thanks to his wonderful goals from set pieces and his defensive solidity as a whole. But he himself has benefited hugely from being given time to settle into the squad. Whereas when he was brought in last season, not starting as many games, but this season he's very much taken on a starting berth. And I think the final factor, Ali, I'll definitely, you know, this is something that struck in my mind, is that last season, when Taiwo Awoniyi's goals were drying up, the team's performances were drying up. And this season, you've seen Geraldo Becker has been expected to take up that mantle. But when his goals have dried up, and that is the case, he hasn't scored since November the 9th against Augsburg. I think his last goal was in a 2-2 draw. He hasn't scored since before the World Cup. But even without his goals, the team has found a way to secure results, secure points, and goals have come from elsewhere. So Jordan Sibacher has come up with goals early on. You've seen someone like Danilo Duki, obviously, I mentioned him before. He has come up with important goals. We've seen Kevin Behrens, you know, the perennial Bundesliga journeyman, you know, playing in the lower divisions, playing in the third division now, earlier, and now playing in the Bundesliga. It's another wonderful story of Union's team. And all of these players have just collectively come together to replace those goals and be able to bring about results where they weren't able to do so previously. So I think all of these factors have had, you know, a contributing effect to Union's title push, if you want to call it, this season. But I think the fans at the moment, they just want to enjoy the ride.
Yeah, definitely, Nenad. I think with Union as well, there's almost a sort of overarching theme of the club's identity on a wider note, over and above the playing identity, in terms of the pace with which they've shot up the Bundesliga table, and the pace with which they've grown since achieving promotion to the Bundesliga. And I think probably there will be some more traditional fans who are probably thinking, whoa, 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 let's just slow it down. Let's not get too big. Let's not attract too many fans from further afield, you know, fans who have not been here for the ride. And I can understand that. I think because it's such a traditional club, because the fans, well, every fan arguably values its club's traditions of course. But I think at Union in particular, there's an added weight attached to those traditions, to that identity. So yeah, I think we spoke about Union previously on the podcast, and I referenced, you might or might not be familiar with this particular meme, Ninad, but the Lemmy sketch when he goes, "At what cost?" And I think some Union Berlin fans probably would say, yeah, we've qualified, if they were to qualify for the Champions League. We've qualified for the Champions League, but at what cost? I don't know. Maybe I'm overanalyzing it. Maybe I'm picking it apart too much. Maybe all the Union fans are just enjoying the ride. And I think, as you say, that's probably what they should be doing. But yeah, part of me does wonder, for a club which has such great tradition, and which has shot up the Bundesliga table since achieving promotion a few years ago, yeah, you do wonder if the pace with which they've achieved that progress maybe might actually be to almost the detriment of the club's overall identity. Probably not. And if they were to qualify for the Champions League, if they were to miraculously win the Bundesliga, for what it's worth, I think they'll probably fall short there. I think we can safely say that. But if they were to miraculously do that, that would eclipse even Leicester's story. What was that? 2015, 2016? That would eclipse even that story, and probably would go down as one of the greatest sporting stories ever. Okay, now turning our attention away from Union Berlin, we could speak about them all evening. Fantastic story, fantastic players, a great manager as well, and yeah, a real identity, as you say. We could talk about them all evening, but I think we do also need to talk about Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund. Borussia Dortmund, since the World Cup, have been fantastic. Bayern Munich have wobbled a little bit. Yes, they brushed aside Union Berlin on Sunday with that 3-0 win, which I think, as Andy Brassel put it, almost just served to reiterate the significance of the achievement at Union, that they're even competing with Bayern at the top end of the table. But yeah, quite aside from, I suppose, that performance on Sunday, and just generally looking at Bayern and generally looking at Borussia Dortmund post-World Cup, how would we assess their recent performances and the current moods in their respective camps, Ninad?
So I think with Dortmund, Ali, I think they've been on a spectacular, you know, form of results and performances since the season has resumed. Obviously, a lot of factors off the pitch have also contributed to that positive mood in the camp. I think Sebastian Haller's return from, you know, his cancer and his recovery, his speedy recovery, and the way he's come back and straight into the team is almost miraculous to think about. You know, it's a hugely commendable feat. And I think, again, those sort of things, you know, him coming back into the team has probably pushed them even further, that, you know, this is the season that we have to go for it, especially more with, you know, us talking about Bayern having a bit of a wobble. And with Dortmund, you know, it's amazing how well they've done this season. And in terms of just 2023, when you look at their form, I think they're the only team currently in Europe who are enjoying a 100% record. And they haven't lost any games, any competitive fixtures in 2023, which I think speaks to Edin Terzic's man management skills, and in how he's been able to help players like Julian Brandt also find form once again. He's been able to, Karim Adeyemi, of course, he's had the injury recently, but before that injury, he was beginning to show a bit of form once again. And just the team as a whole, I think they've really tuned in and focused on the fact that they have to put in their absolute best foot forward to make sure that they push Bayern all the way. And we've seen Dortmund sides in the past. They have been in the title conversation, but they've never really realized their potential. And maybe this is the season that they do it. And maybe this is the season that they take advantage of Bayern's potential slip-up under Nagelsmann this season. And yeah, speaking about them a little bit more, I think, you know, despite the wobble, let's be clear, this is still a team that are clear favorites for the title. There is no hiding away from the fact, and there is no shying away from that. I think they have had a lot of noise off the pitch to deal with. You've seen Manuel Neuer, all of the drama off the pitch with that, with his goalkeeping coach leaving the club, with Nagelsmann's potential, his authority potentially being questioned by other players in the club. You know, we've seen some sort of imbalance there. But even despite all of that, I think they've been able to pick up results. And I think that again speaks to their qualities as a champion. I think Nagelsmann recently spoke in one of his press conferences and said that after you've ridden a roller coaster a multiple number of times, it probably isn't as exciting doing it, you know, doing it again and again. And when you do it multiple times, it's not as exciting as you do it for the first time. So it's interesting the analogy he used there. And again, we've seen Bayern transform. I think they were more or less a Müller Lewandowski team earlier, and now they've become a Jamal Musiala team, where if Musiala does well, the whole team tends to do well. But when he's been shut down by opposition teams, I think there was a run of fixtures more recently when they drew three games in a row. But since then, of course, they've picked up form. But in those three games, we saw Musiala's influence limited. So I think if Musiala can be shut down, I think teams have figured out that there is a way to contain this Bayern side. And yeah, I think that again has contributed to some of the wobble that we've seen this season from them. But I do think that at the end of it all, they'll figure it out. And I do expect them to be champions again, because that is how it goes in the Bundesliga, isn't it?
34 games of football, and at the end of the season, Bayern Munich are champions. I think, yeah, you're quite right to point out those sort of distractions off the field with the Manuel Neuer interview, with the goalkeeper coach leaving. I think with Hasan Salihamidžić as well, he's ruffled a few feathers in his time at Bayern Munich. And I think, yeah, it's almost like for Bayern not to win the Bundesliga, or rather the only team that can stop Bayern from winning the Bundesliga is Bayern, I think would be an accurate way to put it. And yeah, if Bayern keep, I suppose, tripping themselves up, if teams can, yeah, sort of limit the impact that Musiala has on games, then maybe, just maybe, the door will be ever so slightly ajar for Borussia Dortmund to nip in and, yeah, win the Bundesliga. I think Dortmund as well do tend to trip themselves up too. I think you've got a team in Dortmund who, certainly up until just before the World Cup, we were asking serious questions about their resilience, about their ability to push Bayern Munich for the title. But as you say, since the World Cup, they seem to have found that resilience. They seem to have found that mental strength. They've had a few late winners and a few big moments late on in games. So potentially they could push Bayern all the way. And I think looking further down the table, we're not going to look in too much detail at RB Leipzig, for example, but they're certainly putting together a decent run of sorts too. I think, yeah, for the first time in a while, perhaps, I've got faith that Bayern Munich won't have it all their own way. But as you say, Nenad, I think that the sceptic in me is just thinking there's going to be nothing other than a Bayern victory at the end of the season. But regardless of who lifts the Bundesliga title come the end of the season, I think we've had a really quite pulsating title race. We've still got five teams arguably still in it, although I doubt Union or Freiburg could really genuinely challenge Bayern. But you've still got five teams there. And I suppose even going down to Frankfurt in sixth place there, what, 8 points behind Bayern, if I'm recalling the table correctly. So probably out of the equation for now anyway. But you've got three teams, Bayern, Leipzig and Dortmund, who are absolutely in with the shout. You've got Union as outsiders who could just potentially trump the lot of them. And then you've got, I suppose, Freiburg as well. If they can pick back up again after a couple of squeaky results, shall we say, then, yeah, they're only, what, 5 points behind Bayern Munich, who have shown over the last couple of months that they are more than capable of slipping up as well. Okay, a quite tantalising title race indeed in the Bundesliga. Nenad, thank you so much for joining us to unpack all of that. I'll give you the chance now just to promote your Everybody Eats podcast, if you would like to just say a few words on that, point the listeners in the direction of that particular podcast.
No, absolutely. And a fair warning to listeners, this is not a rival podcast to Road to Nowhere. We are, if anything, we are just friends.
Yes.
So, and yeah, if you'd like to listen to our upcoming episode, which will be on Olympique Marseille, you can find us on Twitter at Everybody Eats, and you can find us on all of your preferred podcast platforms. We're available everywhere, I think. And I personally made sure that we are available everywhere. But yeah, we appreciate every listener that comes our way. And yeah, long may the love for Ligue 1 continue.
Absolutely, yeah, Nenad. I think if our listeners enjoy my rambles on Ligue 1 on the Road to Nowhere podcast, then I like to think that they would enjoy what you and Alex mull over on the Everybody's Eats podcast. Okay, well, we're going to wrap up our overview of the Bundesliga title race there. We're going to turn our attention to Spain. We're going to dial in Rudy Barlow. We'll be right back. It looked as if the title race was all over after a tense Madrid derby last Saturday, which saw Real Madrid rescue a 1-1 draw. 18-year-old Alvaro Rodriguez came on to head home a late equaliser after Jose Maria Jimenez had given 10-man Atletico Madrid the lead. However, Barcelona's defeat to Almeria has given Los Blancos a lifeline in the La Liga title race. It's amazing how 24 hours can change the perspective on a picture, but a few days on, what did you see from these two teams from a very cold Santiago Bernabeu, Barlow?
Yes, as I was just saying to you beforehand, it was absolutely Baltic at the Bernabeu. I did not sign up for that when I came to Spain, but I did have the game at least to keep my attention off the cold, off the biting cold, which wouldn't have been out of place at Tynecastle or perhaps at Rugby Park even.
Indeed.
But what did I see? I saw a game between two teams that are a long way from perfect, if I'm honest. Some people I saw kind of online as I was catching up with the kind of Twitter reaction to the game and the paraphernalia that followed it weren't too enamoured with this as a game, but I think it kind of goes to show just how different games can look or how different games can feel when you're in a stadium, because I thought it was pretty engaging and pretty interesting, at least intriguing, if not perhaps an end-to-end thriller, which, to be honest, I mean, if you turn up for the Madrid derby and you expect that, you're probably going to be disappointed anyway. I thought Real Madrid looked pretty tired, I'm not going to lie. They did have that sort of tiredness from midweek, and that was certainly a factor. But I think we saw kind of what's developing into their main problems this season is the fact that even though Karim Benzema is still a very good striker, even though he's still a very good number nine, and even though he's still their top scorer in La Liga, this is not the same Karim Benzema, certainly yet, that we've seen last season, that we saw kind of towards even the very first games of this season. And why does that make such a big difference? It's because, I don't know if you can kind of recall, I was kind of writing about this today for Football España, is back in about sort of April, May time during the Champions League, we're receiving or we're reading a lot of kind of think pieces on how Benzema was the 9.5, how he was a 10 and then he became a 9, and because he still has that aspect of the 10, that makes him so good and that makes him so hard to stop. And part of that was the sort of interplay with Vinicius, the fact that they kind of weaved in and out of each other and made such a good partnership. And he's still a reference point for this Real Madrid. But one of the things that I think we saw against Atleti was that between the lines, there was very little between sort of the defence and the midfield, causing midfielders to kind of turn it and to look behind them and to be sort of uncertain. There was very little of that, certainly until Luka Modric came on, which kind of helped the issue. But we also saw why Rodrigo Goes has been so important for Ancelotti this season, because not only has he come in and played instead of Benzema, but he's tried to sort of be part of the foil for Real Madrid and for that side. If you look at the way in the Liverpool game, he was kind of the link, that kind of third function in that attack, and Benzema finished his goals very well, but Rodrigo is just so important if you don't have that aspect of Benzema to take on that kind of play in between the lines. And I think it creates a really interesting debate for Ancelotti going into these final stages of the season. If you are, Rodrigo was injured against Atleti, I should say, he's potentially going to be injured for the El Clasico coming up on Thursday, which will be, you will have watched before this episode is out. But yeah, going into those final stages of the season, we saw a very settled Real Madrid in those last 2 months, where you had Fede Valverde on the right-hand side, you had Benzema and Vinicius sort of left to their own devices to a certain extent. And now Ancelotti's going to have to either see a more fitter, sharper Benzema come back, and that kind of solves a lot of problems, and you can kind of revert to what you had, and maybe you switch Camavinga or Tchouaméni in the midfield, but you don't have that issue. Whereas if you do have to go with Rodrigo, you do have to commit that some kind of extra player in attack, and then that leaves you a little bit more vulnerable in defence, and then it's, do you press up? Do you wait for the opposition? These are all questions that are going to be kind of revolving around Ancelotti's mind and Davide Ancelotti's mind as well at some point in the next kind of few weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. And for Atleti, I was the most impressed I've been with Atleti all season, I have to say. They were organised. They dealt with setbacks well. Reinildo Mandava, who's going to be a huge loss, he went off with an ACL after about 35 minutes, but they dealt with it well. They did not sort of crumble after that. They didn't really show any signs of it affecting them at all. They backed each other up. They helped each other out. And while Molina dealt with Vinicius pretty well as can be hoped, and he always had somebody in behind him, Stefan Savic more often than not in this case. And they attacked well as well. They attacked aggressively. Alvaro Morata came on when Atleti had 10 men on the park, which I thought was a real show of intent from Simeone and a desire to move them up the field as opposed to just defend at that point. That's where they get the goal from. They get a free kick up the park. Jimenez heads it in. And the fact that he brought on Correa for Pablo Torre, the fact that he started Pablo Torre, who's only 19, and generally Diego Simeone doesn't particularly like to start youngsters in big games, but the fact that he started him, and then the fact that he brought on Angel Correa to go more attacking in that second half, I thought that was a real show of ambition from Simeone. It's a real show of boldness. And yeah, they just looked confident. They looked sure of themselves in terms of what they were doing. And that's been a real departure from the Atleti that we've seen for a lot of this season. And the fact that even that they were just organised in defence, even that they had kind of mechanisms in place to deal with Real Madrid, that's not been the norm for Atleti this season. So I was very impressed. And I think that this gives them a base to build off going forward. Whether they can replicate that, they're not going to have as much space against other teams, obviously, as they did against Real Madrid. But yeah, I was highly impressed with Atleti. And they don't have much to play for other than the top four, but they certainly have something to build off now.
Indeed, Barlow, indeed. Meanwhile, the relegation battle has gotten no less tight at the bottom, but one side making strides to get out of it are Celta Vigo. It was a steady start under Carlos Carvajal, who is known for his free-flowing football and will be familiar to many in England too. He appears to be getting a real tune out of Celta though, led by one of the brightest talents in, perhaps we can even say, European football right now. We are talking, of course, about Gabri Veiga. Tell us more, Barlow.
Yes, Carlos Carvajal, I think we kind of know him as this free-flowing kind of positional coach that likes to kind of really exploit players' talents and likes to have them as kind of a very technical side. And when he started, it was a lot of 0-0s. So it was a lot of clean sheets. They were pretty good. They were pretty solid, but it wasn't exactly what we were expecting from a Celta side that does have talent, that does have attacking players. And you look at them now, and we're starting to see that kind of Celta come back. We're starting to see them take the game to other teams. A couple of weeks ago, they kind of drew with Real Sociedad away from home, but they did so with 10 men after going down. They attacked. They deserved their point. There was a game recently against Betis as well, where they were very good. They beat them 4-3. And then again against Valladolid at the weekend, 3-0, a brace from Gabri Veiga, who also got an assist in what was just a standout kind of man of the match performance from him. And yeah, we are starting to see kind of Celta do seem to go through cycles of kind of playing up and sort of really matching their talent and then sort of hitting a bit of a roadblock. But right now, what we're seeing is Carlos Carvajal really, yeah, kind of get a tune out of them, as you say. And I think it's very promising for them to have somebody in Gabri Veiga. And they've got two target men as well, which I like about them. They've got Jörg Strand Larsen and they've got Haris Seferovic, who's just come in the January window. Before that, they had Gonzalo Paciencia, which might have been known to anyone who follows Frankfurt. And so what we have there is kind of a target man who, regardless of whether they're playing well or not, is going to be a handful. For the very least, he's going to distract attention. You've got Gabri Veiga, who's coming from deep. And then all that does is kind of opens up a little bit more space for Iago Aspas, because for so long he's been kind of alone in his exploits and creating magic out of nothing. But when you have that kind of those other threats, it really does open it up for him. And so yeah, I've really liked what I've seen from Celta of late. They are, I think it's in 2023 or since Carvajal took over, Sam Leveridge piece on La Liga Lowdown was telling me that they are, I think, in the top four since Carvajal took over, which is pretty good going. And given the fact that they're still only about 4 or 5 points clear of the relegation zone tells you just how tight it is down there. Everyone is picking up points and everyone can beat everyone. So yeah, Sevilla looked like they were kind of climbing out of it recently. They don't look particularly out of it right now. They're kind of level on points with Celta, and Celta are on the up. They look positive. And just coming on to Gabri Vega very quickly, yeah, I mentioned him on the Scout Football podcast with Joe Donoghue. Hello, if you were directed here by my shout-outs on that podcast, and welcome. But Gabri Vega, and I'm going to repeat some of the stats here, but goals and assists in La Liga, he's eighth. Goals, he's eighth. If you look at his kind of XG, he's outperforming it by 3.6. So that's third in La Liga. He's got some really good sort of take on and dribbling stats as well. He ranks in the kind of top 10 for them. Shots on target, he's fifth. This is a guy who's got a real relationship with the goal. And he seems to, whether it's kind of coming from deep or whether it's making those runs in behind the defence himself, whether it's pouncing on those rebounds or those cutbacks, he seems to have an eye for goal, even though he's not playing necessarily up front. And having those kind of goals from deep can be massive for any side. But to get those from a 20-year-old, who has a bit about him, he has a trick, he tends to kind of quicken the pace of the games, and he can beat a man as well. That's pretty important. And I was saying on the Scout Football podcast that he's kind of reminds me a bit of a number 10 who's just kind of been slung out wide for the early stages of his career, which is kind of, that is the tribute you have to pay if you're one of those creative players. But it's really coming to fruition for Carvajal, and between him, Vega, and Aspas, and so the other attacking talent they have, it's looking really promising. And yeah, I mean, the Spanish Football Podcast, various other podcasts have been trying to direct attention away from Vega so that he doesn't get snapped up by a Premier League club this week. And you can see why, because he's really quite exciting, and Celta look exciting again.
Yeah, absolutely. Barlow, one of those players who, based on the glimpses of him that I've seen, seems like, yeah, one of those players who has that elusive, special something. Okay. Ahead of the round of 16 of the Europa League and the Conference League, there are four Spanish sides in action, including another trip to Spain for Manchester United and a second return of the season for Jose Mourinho. Just give us a whistle-stop tour, I suppose, of how these sides are shaping up going into their respective ties, Barlow.
Yes, so we'll keep it brief, but this will give you kind of an idea of what to watch or what you might want to delve into in Europe. So to speak, I'll start with Sevilla, where I kind of left off at the end of the last answer. Jorge Sampaoli's side have been on the up, they have been improving, but those European ties, the kind of midweek ties, are going to take their toll on their legs, and we saw that against Osasuna at the weekend. They got beaten 3-2, having had a 100% home record up until then in 2023. So it's a side that's strong at home. They're still lacking a goal scorer, but Youssef En-Nesyri is hitting a bit of form, and we know when he gets streaky, he can be very effective. It's a side that probably isn't totally solid defensively, but does have a number of attacking players. Sampaoli likes to press high. Pape Gay has been fantastic to watch in recent weeks. So I think their tie against Fenerbahce is going to be pretty even, to be honest. I think it could be a fairly good watch, even though Fenerbahce are a little bit off the pace, I think, in the Turkish league just now. I think that matches them up nicely. And I think that's why, for me, Europa League is the most fun competition in Europe, is because it's imperfect teams going against each other in knockout stages, where sometimes in the Champions League it can be a little bit more cagey, so to speak, but also there's just less mistakes. What I like about Real Betis Manchester United is the fact that United will have the kind of tie turned on its head, because even though they did kind of dominate for large stages of the Barcelona match, this all the pressure is going to be on them, and it's going to be up to them to kind of make the running. I think Betis, let's not beat about the bush, they are struggling. They've been up and down in their form, kind of just about beating the teams that they need to, but also dropping points against the teams that have been better than them. But in this case, you have a side that tends to come through tricky moments and adversity pretty well. I think Pellegrini obviously has Manchester City history. He has a lot of European experience. You've got an exciting player like Luis Enrique to take the tie to Manchester United. So this could be pretty good fun as well. I think Betis are heavy underdogs, but United, I think they'll have a test at least at the Benito Villamarine. Well, it'll be absolutely rocking, 50,000-60,000 people in Seville. Real Sociedad, who topped the group with Manchester United, are facing Roma, as you say. I think that's going to be a fantastic tie because La Real, they've been in very good form. We've spoken about them a lot. I won't sort of go over ground that we've dug up before too much, but they are one of the better teams in Spain. They've had a few bumps of late, but I think that's partly to do with sort of injured players coming back into the side, regaining a bit of match fitness. This should be a really good fun tie against Jose Mourinho's Roma, who obviously will probably cede the ball to Real Sociedad. And so I think we could see a pretty back and forth team because La Real like to press high. Mourinho likes to counter attack. So this could be quite an interesting one as well. And two brilliant destinations if you happen to go to both legs of it. And then finally, Villarreal, I'll just finish up on. Quique Setién got a crucial win against Getafe on Monday night, 2-1 over them. But Villarreal are not in a good state, to be honest. And I think there's rumours of him getting sacked again recently. I think Setién has a job to keep the dressing room on his side right now. And so they face Anderlecht, who are ninth in the Belgium League, which they should be strong favourites for that. They have the quality to beat them. They're one of the favourites for the competition. And I do think they'll make it through. But if things start to go wrong, if things go pear-shaped early on in that game, or in the first leg, then you could be in for the real shock. So yeah, the yellow submarine is certainly not cruising these days. It's choppy waters for Quique Setién.
Lovely, Barlow. Some lovely sea references, marine references there as well. Thoroughly here for that. Yeah, I think when you talk about those ties, it's fair to say that those knockout ties are laced with quite mouth-watering narratives. So yeah, we'll need to keep a very close eye on those games, as I'm sure you will, Rudy Barlow, no doubt. Okay, well, I think we will wrap up there our analysis of Spanish football. We're going to take a quick break before coming back to look at my beloved Strasbourg, who have had a rather difficult season this time around. We'll be right back.
In France, four teams will of course be relegated from the top flight of French football this year as Ligue 1 transitions to an 18-team league for the 2023 to 2024 campaign. Now, your beloved Strasbourg were excellent last season, finishing sixth and narrowly missing out on European football. This time around, however, they've really struggled. A woeful run of just one win in their opening 17 league games left the club in 19th place and spelled the end for coach Julien Stéphan. Since then, Les Strasbourgeois have shown glimpses of improvement, registering 3 wins and a draw across 7 matches under the guidance of Mathieu Lescornu and Frédéric Antonetti. Why have Strasbourg struggled this season? And looking ahead, how do you rate their chances of survival?
Yeah, it's always tricky to talk about Strasbourg when things aren't going too well for Les Strasbourgeois. But yeah, when Strasbourg parted company with Julien Stéphan, for most supporters, it was a case of smile because it's over, I suppose, but also a case of smile because it happened. Now, you're quite right to mention that dreadful run of one win in their opening 17 league games, and I'm laughing because it's probably a case of if you don't laugh, you'll cry. But yeah, it was a terrible run, and I'll come on to discuss the factors behind that run shortly. Before we get our teeth into all of that, however, I do think there's value in casting our minds back to last season when Strasbourg were so brilliant under Stéphan and came so close to securing European football at the minnow. They were really fun to watch at times last time out with lots of movement off the ball in the final third, good use of overloading wingbacks in that 3-5-2 formation, and the almost, shall we say, inimitable forward play of Ludovic Ajorc lighting up the Meno. Particularly as well in the second half of the season, the team were really solid defensively and they played in a way that made it so difficult for the opposition to get into Strasbourg's box. They would push teams out wide and then apply pressure to win the ball back in high areas and then generate attacks from that platform. They were, however, Michael, overachieving, and I think Stefan actually has to take a lot of credit for that. It's perhaps a cliche to say this, but he did get the most out of each and every player just about, and he was tactically flexible, he fine-tuned his side depending on the opposition, and the players really bought into what he was trying to do with the intricate system he wanted to implement. This season, however, things very quickly went downhill and got very ugly for Stefan and Strasbourg. The club's early season woes can be attributed in large part, I think, to the fact that so many players were injured or unavailable for selection, and that gave the campaign a real stop-start feel. Stefan couldn't find any real continuity in his starting 11. Now, just to name a few names, Jairzinho Niamse, Ludovic Ajork, Ibrahima Sissoko, Thomas Delaney, Sanjin Pursic, Karol Fila, Lebo Matiba, Dimitri Lina, Luca Peram and Maxime Le Marchand have all been out for one reason or another at some point this season. And most of those players, anyway, maybe with the exception of Lebo Matiba and perhaps Karol Fila, most of those players are players who would be in and around the first team most weeks. Strasbourg didn't have the deepest of squads anyway, and so when you couple those injuries with the lack of new arrivals in the summer, I don't think we can be too surprised that they floundered in the first half of the campaign. I touched there on that sort of lack of new arrivals over the summer transfer window, and there was definitely a degree of frustration amongst the support that the club didn't spend more cash over the summer after they'd finished in sixth last season. It was a case of, well, let's build on that. Let's keep going. Let's, I suppose, maintain and then push on, if you like, try and qualify for Europe. But the club almost took a step back. The club almost, I think a lot of it can be traced back to the years at the turn of the century and in towards sort of the 2010s when Strasbourg really struggled financially. The club was mismanaged, shall we say, financially, and they went down to the really sort of lower echelons, if you like, of French football. So I think it was maybe a case of once bitten, twice shy when it comes to Strasbourg's summer spending or lack thereof. This time around, the club spent just over £4 million on players, and let's not forget that they lost local hero Anthony Cacci on a free transfer to Mainz. Looking at the team's performances collectively, those performances have been nowhere near the same level as last season. The momentum, the confidence, the swagger with which the club played for large parts of the previous campaign, all of that seems to have evaporated, or rather seemed to have evaporated at the start of the season. And just focusing on what you said, Michael, four teams will of course go down from Ligue 1 this season, so the aforementioned inactivity over the summer seems particularly baffling. On an individual level, some of the stars of the previous campaign struggled to reach the same heights this time around. Sanjin Pursic was the quintessential string puller for Strasbourg last season. Adrian Thomasson was a real nuisance for opposition defences, and Ludovic Ajork played a key role in attack. All three, however, had been way, way, way off the pace this season. Coincidentally, Thomasson and Ajork were both sold in the January transfer window to Lens? How dare I? French blasphemy there. To Lens and Mainz, respectively, to free up some cash for the stadium renovations at the Menno. We are, Michael, starting to see the emergence of a rather worrying trend for Julian Stefan, whereby when the going gets tough, Stefan's teams don't really get going. Now, let's not forget that it ended in tears at Rennes 2 when Stefan resigned following a run of one win in 10 games, which saw the club slip from fourth all the way down to ninth in the table. And yeah, at the end of last season, some really big names were reported looking at appointing Stefan, and he was being talked about as one of the best managers, or rather one of the best young managers in Europe. Fast forward 9 months or so, and here we go, this developing pattern started to go wrong. They were on this terrible run, and there was, I suppose, a lack of resilience on the part of Stefan's side. So you do have to think that clubs would probably now think twice about appointing Julian Stefan. Initially, for sure, he does get results, but at Rennes and now Strasbourg, we're seeing a tendency for things to go sour, to go downhill. I do hope Stefan can learn from this. I hope he can come back stronger, more resilient, but I'm just not entirely sure where he goes from here. Before we turn our attention to Stefan's permanent replacement, I would just like to quickly give some flowers to his assistant, Mathieu Liscorne, who took charge on an interim basis following Stefan's departure and definitely steadied the ship to an extent. He oversaw two wins and a draw in his six games in charge, with the victory away at Lyon a real highlight. One of the goals in particular in that away win at Lyon, I think it was Habib Diallo who squeezed the ball over the line, was the quintessential stramash. I'm not quite sure how the French would refer to a stramash, but yeah, an absolute stramash of a goal. Do go and check that one out if you've not already seen it. But Liscorne, to come back to him, he was a really popular figure with the Strasbourg support, and he's definitely left with their best wishes. In mid-February, the club appointed 61-year-old Frederic Antonetti as head coach. He's been without a club since leaving rivals Metz last summer, and I must admit I was rather underwhelmed by the club's decision to bring him in. However, for what Strasbourg need right now, I guess his appointment does make sense. What Antonetti brings in abundance is experience. He has a staggering 618 league and matches under his belt as a coach. As well as Metz, he's managed SC Bastia, Saint-Étienne, Nice, Stade Rennais, Lille and Japanese side Osaka. Over the years, Antonetti has developed a reputation, perhaps unfairly, as a sort of French version of Big Sam Allardyce. But his record at Metz, Bastia and Saint-Étienne in particular really does speak for itself. He took Bastia to a Coupe de la Ligue final and led them into Europe on more than one occasion. He guided Saint-Étienne back into the top flight of French football after a brief hiatus at the start of the century, at the turn of the century rather. And he set Metz well on their way to the Ligue 2 title 4 or 5 years ago. The football his teams play, I'll not lie, it's hardly breathtaking, and his appointment certainly represents a sea change from the Stefan era. That said, if Antonetti can steady the ship and keep the club up, he'll have gone a long way towards winning over the Strasbourg faithful. Just on a closing note, Michael, I do think we have to address the elephant in the room, shall we say, that is Todd Bowley's supposed interest in acquiring a 100% stake in Strasbourg. Now, L'Equipe reported late last week that Bowley and his business partners had met with Strasbourg's president, Mark Keller, which for me anyway and for a lot of Strasbourg fans made for quite ominous reading. Now, Keller, the president at Strasbourg, does have a lot of credit in the bank, and what I would say is that the Strasbourg fans are unwaveringly loyal. There's not the same brewing toxicity that we saw at Saint-Étienne and Bordeaux last season. For example, the club has sold out every home game this season, and the matchday experience at the Meno is arguably one of the best in the country. Fan satisfaction levels, at least from the perspective of the matchday experience, you know, they're through the roof. However, I do think Keller's credit with the support would evaporate quite rapidly if he were to entertain the idea of Todd Bowley buying Strasbourg to serve as a feeder club of sorts. Forming part of a multi-club system just doesn't sit at all well with the club's ethos and tradition. I actually spoke as well to my good friend Hervey, who I sat next to and had my season ticket out in Strasbourg, and I said, what is the sentiment on the ground in Strasbourg? What are people saying? And yeah, he was saying that I think a lot of people are quite reticent to buy into the idea of being taken over. I think it's at odds with the club's tradition. And let's not forget, I spoke previously about the financial difficulties at the turn of the century towards kind of the 2010s. And a lot of that was down to, well, you could argue a lot of that was down to a takeover that went wrong. So I think you can understand why Strasbourg fans would be quite reluctant to welcome Todd Bowley with open arms, even if it would mean that there were more funds available to the club. Hopefully, Michael, it's just all noise and Bowley decides to look elsewhere. Okay, well, on that note, I think we will bring this episode to a close. We'll say thank you to the listener for sticking with us throughout this episode. We'll say thank you to Rudy Barlow, and we'll say thank you to Ninad, who of course joined us earlier in this episode. And I'll say thank you as well to you, Michael Jones. What are your plans for the rest of the evening? Is it going to be a chill evening? Is it going to be a busy one unpacking? Or yeah, what do you have lined up?
Yeah, it should be the busy one, but I suspect I'll probably just go for the former and have a relaxing chill one. What about you, Ali?
Well, we're working the magic of podcast recording. So yeah, whilst this episode is finishing for you, the listener, I'm about to go and chat to Nanad retrospectively, the wonders of podcast scheduling. But yeah, so that's what I've got up next, Michael, and then I'll maybe do some editing. And yeah, I'll read my book before heading to bed. It's been a long day today. I was up at 5:30, so I'm looking forward to catching some sleep this evening. Okay, before I send the listeners to sleep with my chat of snoozing, I think, I will say goodbye to you, the listener. I'll say goodbye to Rudy Barlow and Michael Jones. I'll say goodbye to Nanad. And I'll say to you all, stay safe and stay well. Until next time, thank you.